Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Just one guest up today, James Galbraith, who is a professor of economics at the University of Texas, Austin, and who is the editor of a new Library of America one-volume collection of four books by his father, John Kenneth Galbraith. Jamie will talk first about the move towards austerity in Washington, and then about his father's work at the bottom of the hour. It's fitting he'll be talking about Galbraith the Elder during this hour. Along with Keynes, few economists have written so well against how orthodoxy demands austerity and how damaging that is to people and to economies. As we'll hear Jamie Galbraith say shortly, we've been subject to an enormous propaganda campaign trying to convince us that we simply must cut spending because, evidently, a $15 trillion economy can't afford to help the poor, the old, or the sick. I'm recording this on Friday afternoon, so anything I say might be obsolete by Saturday morning, much less the following week, but it is looking like something resembling the Gang of Six's budget compromise may pass. It's basically a rewrite of the Bowles-Simpson deficit reduction plan, which came out several months ago, but which went nowhere on release, though with fewer numbers. It looks like there'll be cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and some tax simplification, which means closing loopholes while lowering overall tax rates. As I'm writing, word was that the tax deal might be punted into the future, but the spending cuts would take priority in the present. Some Democrats have rebelled against this formula, and Republican backbenchers may rebel over any suggestion of tax increases and/or what they deem insufficient cuts in spending. We'll see. I suspect that Wall Street will inform the intransigent of their class duty, and something like this will pass after a lot of posturing and moaning. The distributional devils are all in the details of such a scheme. An analysis of the Bowles-Simpson plan by the Tax Policy Center showed that variations on the original theme could alter the distributional effects greatly. Some versions would make the federal tax system somewhat more progressive, others less so. It's a safe bet, though, that anything emerging from this Congress is unlikely to make the system more progressive. More regressive would be the safer bet. It would also raise less revenue than letting the Bush tax cuts expire, and would also be less progressive than letting that happen, since over half of the benefits go to the richest 5% of taxpayers. But the spending cuts will undoubtedly be regressive, and deeper than they would have to be if the Bush tax cuts were allowed to fade away. Should something like this compromise pass Congress, it would be a big deal. It would mean a large austerity program would be imposed after the most opaque and stupid debate imaginable in the midst of a faltering recovery from the worst crisis in over 70 years. It will take money from non-elites. The only open question is just how much it would give to the rich. Politically, it would mean a major attack on popular social programs that benefit or will benefit almost everyone, programs that were once considered bedrock commitments or brand features of the Democratic Party. This awful scheme would be endorsed by a Democratic president. If a Republican president tried to do this, it's not difficult to imagine crowds in the streets. The politics of all this are so perfect that they almost look scripted. In a rare instance of being usefully informative, New York Times columnist David Brooks reported in March 2009, less than 2 months after Obama took office, when the economy was still in collapse and his reputation as Whoopi Changey was still intact, that Obama, and this is a quote, is extremely committed to entitlement reform and is plotting politically feasible ways to reduce Social Security as well as health spending. That's the end of the quote from Brooks. Obama's people also told Brooks that they aim to get non-defense discretionary spending, that is, education, environment, and other mostly good stuff, and a rather small part of the federal budget overall. They wanted to get that down by nearly a third to its lowest level in years. Given the freshness of Obama's election when that was written, by a base that wanted no such agenda, it was going to be a reach to get all that accomplished. So it's quite likely that Obama, the master of preemptive compromise, welcomed the Republican victory in 2010. It would allow him to appear like the reasonable alternative to an insane crew, a crew that he nonetheless happily let set the agenda. Had he wanted to, Obama could have said, "The Republicans want to let the elderly freeze and die sooner so that their rich patrons can get another Jaguar." It would have been very effective, as well as true, but he'd never have done that because the elite consensus is that entitlements must be chopped and he has to raise at least $1 billion from those elites to get reelected. My guess is that many phone calls will be made, expense account dinners eaten, campaign checks written, and maybe a market panic or two mounted, and something like the grand austerity bargain will pass Congress and the president will sign it. And when he does, he'll talk about how he strengthened Social Security and Medicare and stabilized the economy. The real suffering won't start for a few years. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from James Galbraith.
Hi there, everybody. I'm Archie Bell, and these are the Drells, and we're going to do a little thing called the Tighten Up right now. All right, right now we're going to just, when I tell you, George, I want to hear you tighten up on the drums. Tighten up! Oh, yeah, James, now let's tighten up on the bass. I like how me and Bruce both started playing when I said tighten up on the bass. Right, though, let's tighten up on the maracas and the tambourine. Together, Bruce.
That was actually Yola Tango, not Archie Bell and the Drells. That was performed live on WFMU back in 2001 as one of their call-in challenges when listeners named songs for Yola Tango to play. I don't think the song or the performance was intended as a commentary on austere fiscal policy, but that's radio for you. My first guest is James Galbraith, a professor of economics at the University of Texas, Austin, and the editor of a collection of four of his father, John Kenneth Galbraith's, books, just issued as a single fat volume in the excellent Library of America series. The Library of America is best known for publishing the works of classic American writers like Melville, the first volume in the series, Whitman and Twain, but has also published quite a bit of political writing. Galbraith is their first and so far only economist out of the 200 or so volumes they've published. There are very few economists who write well, especially Americans, so it's quite understandable that Galbraith is the first. I have my differences with John Kenneth Galbraith's politics. He was a liberal, with all the limits of that species, and way too hostile to Marx for my taste. But he was a thoughtful and humane writer, and not at all a warrior. He was relentlessly critical of his profession and the malign influence it exerted on public discourse. A lot of his work seems dated now. It reflected the concerns of Golden Age America, when the economy was working pretty well and livelihoods were relatively stable. But there's also a way in which it's become less dated. He was a product of the Great Depression, and so very much in the tradition of Keynes, critical of the austerity party in economics. That gang was very much in the defensive when Galbraith was writing his major works in the 1950s and 1960s, but by God, they're back, and with a vengeance. Given the recent developments in fiscal politics, deficit hysteria, and the Gang of Six scheme, I thought it'd be useful first to talk to Jamie Galbraith about current events. That first, and then after the half-hour break, we'll talk about his father's work. James Galbraith. Welcome, James Galbraith. Before we get to the collection of your father's works you edited, I do want to talk about the current situation, and particularly the current debt limit melodrama and the Gang of Six compromise that seems to be stumbling towards some sort of acceptance, or so it seems now. What do you make of this compromise?
It reminds me of that old remark by Anatole France that the law in its majesty prohibits both the rich and the poor from sleeping under bridges. The principle, the stated principle of the supposed compromise is that the pain of deficit reduction should be shared alike by those who can afford it and those who can't afford it. And as a principle goes, it seems to me that's in conflict with every basic value of the Democratic Party that I remember having been brought up in.
Now, what about the hysteria over the deficit itself? We've talked about this in the past, several months ago, I think. But we're in the midst of this absolute hysteria over red ink and analogies of the United States with Argentina and Greece. Are any of these proper?
No, they're absurd. The problem that Greece has is a very large debt that it has to refinance at very, very high interest rates because it basically cannot control the currency in which the debt is due, and Greece is on the path to a restructuring or a default. The United States is in the opposite position. It has an a very large liquid treasury bond market, which is a safe haven for investors who are worried about turmoil in the world. The interest rates on long-term treasury bonds are historically low. And because the government actually controls the currency in which the debt is due, it cannot run into the kind of financing problems that Greece is in, nor can it. There is a potential that the dollar could lose some value, but nor can we get into the situation that Argentina was in. Argentina had a currency board. It had a large debt denominated in dollars. It defaulted on that debt. That not only is not going to happen to the United States, it in the nature of things, cannot happen to the United States. So these parallels that people draw are just a sign of basically of bad faith, or a combination of bad faith and ignorance, and a desire, it would seem, to force policy choices down the throats of the public on false premises.
I think some people would argue, though, that once the debt-GDP ratio passes some magically toxic level of 90% or 100%, then everything will change. The United States will no longer be in this privileged position of having treasury bonds as good as gold, and no longer be able to borrow limitlessly in its own currency. And so that we will become more like Greece and Argentina should the debt levels rise to that peak. Do you see that?
Well, first of all, the statistical argument for that proposition, which has been made by Kenneth Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart, is flawed. It's not a persuasive argument. It mixes all kinds of apples and oranges without getting into the details. But secondly, as a structural matter, it's wrong. If you read the book that Reinhart and Rogart based this argument on, they fail to distinguish clearly between debts that are owed in somebody else's currency, where you have to earn that currency by exporting, by running an export surplus in order to service them, and the situation that the United States is in which the Treasury bond is issued in dollars. In the final analysis, the Federal Reserve can buy the bonds. It's simply not possible for the United States to get into a situation where the bond markets actually refuse to take up offerings from the Treasury. It hasn't happened, and it isn't going to happen unless there's a political decision, unless there's some kind of deliberately constructed political impasse that makes it happen. It can't happen for economic reasons, in other words.
I think some people would say that what you're suggesting sounds like there's always a possibility if the Federal Reserve could monetize the debt, that would mean inflation, and that would provoke riots at bond trading desks around the world, and the party would then be over. What do you say to that?
That's simply not true. The Federal Reserve can and does buy treasury bonds in substantial volumes. It was doing so as part of its quantitative easing program until just a few weeks ago. The point of that is to make cash freely available to the public. And there's absolutely no inflationary effect. I mean, the reality is that the price level is governed in the world economy by global phenomena. We could have an inflation because of, let's say, rising oil prices. We're not going to have one because of rising labor costs, because things are basically nailed down by the price of imports. While inflation is a theoretical possibility, the risk of it under current conditions, when you've got 9% unemployment, is just minimal in the extreme.
What about the projections of ever-rising debt levels that the Congressional Budget Office produces? Two-part question. One is that if you look at the CBO's baseline projections, which are if Congress does nothing, the deficit recedes towards about 3% of GDP, which all but really insane people agree is a reasonable and sustainable level. The problems, if there are any, don't really start until after, say, 2020. So what about this current hysteria over 9 or 10% of GDP deficits? Is this a real thing, or people using this as a pretext?
Well, one of the strangest things about this whole debate is the role played in it by the Congressional Budget Office baseline economic forecasts, which are a mechanical exercise, basically, that is done by a team of technicians there and has a specific purpose. which is to allow members of Congress to get a reliable estimate of what a bill will cost and what the budget effect of some proposed piece of legislation would be. The CBO itself says that these baselines should not be taken as an actual economic forecast, which is what everybody seems to be doing with them. If you try to use them that way, you have to come to grips with the fact that they are internally inconsistent in very serious ways. And just to give you, I think, the most serious inconsistency, when you look out over 3 or 4 years, the CBO is saying that they expect the short-term interest rate, which is set by the Federal Reserve, basically is a rate that banks use to decide what the price of an overnight loan will be, the rate, which is essentially the rate on short-term treasury bond, treasury bills, that's going to rise to between 4 and 5% from its current zero. And that is going to do so even though there's no increase in inflation between now and then. But when you put those two assumptions together, that's what gives you the very dramatic run-up in deficits to GDP and in the debt-to-GDP ratio. It's an interest rate which is compounding more rapidly than the growth rate of the economy. It's not going to happen. It cannot happen. If the Federal Reserve were so foolish as to drive up the interest rate by 400 or 500 basis points from where it is now, I mean, you can imagine what would happen. There would be massive increase in defaults on mortgages. The bond prices would collapse. What's called the yield curve, which governs the terms under which companies borrow for the long term, would go inverted. It would collapse. Nobody would get long-term money. There would be a deep recession. So this is simply not a theoretical possibility that this could happen in the way the CBO is projecting. And yet this is the forecast on which everybody seems to have hung all of their vast anxiety about the rising deficit and the rising debt-to-GDP ratio.
But if you look also, if you go further out several decades, they're forecasting extremely slow rates of economic growth for a very long period of time, growth rates we really haven't seen except for short periods of depression in American history. Trustees of the Social Security system do something rather similar. Do you think these forecasts are plausible? Are we facing like decades and decades of really stagnant GDP growth, or is this a convenient assumption for projections to prod things in an austere direction?
Well, it could be a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you follow a track of unremitting austerity, that you just end up with stagnation. But no, I mean, the normal procedure for a long-term forecast is to look at what is the past record, and these forecasts are typically well below that. To me, that's not the most important question. It's really the relationship between the growth rate and the interest rate. So, yeah, if you have a low growth rate and a high interest rate, you're going to end up with a compounding debt burden. But there's no plausible reason to expect that's going to be the actual scenario.
Do you see any signs that there are any skeptics in Washington, or is this universally believed?
Well, we've been the subject of a massive propaganda campaign, there are people who will express their skepticism in private and their frustration in private, it's extremely hard to go against a consensus in the press, a consensus in the financial sector, amongst the financial community, people who fund campaigns. And the general desire to hold opinions on these complex and technical subjects, which are, respectable. It's a very powerful force, and we've seen it in other matters. I think it's very comparable, for example, to the way in which the Bush administration got widespread support for the invasion of Iraq. A lot of people had misgivings and suspected that things would go badly, but weren't willing to express them for fear of appearing, outside the consensus and unsupportive of the troops.
So what would the long-term effect of, if something like this Gang of Six framework is adopted, what would the effects distributional and economic be?
Well, the most dangerous thing in the Gang of Six proposal that I've seen so far is the proposal to change the basis for adjusting the cost of living on Social Security, which has the effect, bit by bit, year by year, of reducing the real value of those benefits. And that means that people who are in their 50s, 60s, 70s now won't see a major reduction at first, but they will see when they get to be in their 80s and 90s and their private money runs out and they're really relying on Social Security, they will be on their uppers. They will be have significantly lower real income than they otherwise would have. There's some other things. There are cutbacks in health care provision. There's a repeal of what's called the Class Act, this new program for provide insurance to cover home health assistance. The question one has to ask is, will these measures, which do real harm to vulnerable people, will they in any way benefit the economic performance of the United States? Is it a good thing for the economy at a, let's say, 25 years from now, an 85 or 90-year-old lives on 10 or 15 or 20% less than they've got now? I say absolutely no benefit. There's a real harm, but there's no benefit. It's certainly implausible in the extreme to argue that the interest rate on 20-year Treasury bonds, which is already at the moment very low, will come down by even a single basis point as a result of enacting this measure. It's in many ways an absurd proposition, which we're being asked to swallow.
I was just reading a David Brooks column this morning from March, I believe, 2009, right after Obama took office, and he quotes the president and many of his advisors saying that they've been wanting to do this. They've been wanting to cut Social Security and Medicare, and we're looking for a plausible way to go about it. I mean, has this been something that they've been eager to do, and they've conveniently had the Tea Party to force their hand and make them do something they wanted to do?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think the White House is entirely in the hands of what Mike Lind calls the Pea Party, the Eat Your Peas Party, which is a group of people that organized themselves around the Hamilton Project under the sponsorship of Robert Rubin years and years ago, and they are now the government of the United States on economic policy. There was a mildly more expansionary group in the White House that included Larry Summers and Christina Romer and Jared Bernstein in the vice president's office, and those people are all gone now. So what we've got is a group that has had Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security cuts on their agenda from the very beginning, and the president has bought into it. And the way to think about this is you have a historic division in the Democratic Party between its popular base, strong element of labor, strong element of the older population, people who respect the New Deal, the Great Society, and for whom Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are very important, and the financial backers of the party, the Wall Street faction, and that for that group, cutting these programs has been their agenda for a long, long time. They almost succeeded in the last years of the Clinton administration. They almost succeeded in 2005 with George W. Bush, and now they've got, they think, all the ducks lined up, and the Tea Party is acting very helpfully raise the specter of a financial meltdown in order to force the deal.
Well, then the Tea Party serves a useful political purpose so that the president can then look like the reasonable alternative, the compromise.
That's right, but a compromise here is a very bad idea. If there is no compromise, then the choice will be between a clean increase in the debt ceiling and I won't say financial Armageddon, but a very uncertain situation in which a lot of people could get very upset. And if it's true that the financial world really believes that going past that August 2nd deadline is going to cause a massive amount of upheaval, then I think we can rely on them to get the clean increase in the debt ceiling rather than go through that. If that's not the case, if I've miscalculated, better to hold the line and to learn that now and then to have this fought out in the political arena than to have a compromise on important programs, on vital programs, as I said, for no economic benefit at all, that will simply lead to the next time the debt ceiling has to be raised, yet another and even more extreme set of demands.
Now, if we got out of Iraq and Afghanistan and let the Bush tax cuts expire, there would really be no deficit problem at all to speak of, but of course that's not really under consideration.
Wait a minute. The Bush tax cuts, the expiration of the Bush tax cuts are already in current law. So if you look at the statutory baseline of the CBO, what current law requires, there is actually no increase in the debt to GDP ratio under their projections, because they have the Bush tax cuts expiring built in. But CBO won't let matters rest there. In fact, they make what is essentially a judgment call, which says that the Bush tax cuts are going to be extended. And then they give you a baseline, which is a modified, they call it a modified baseline, based upon that. So one of the things you have to be aware of here, it's a little bit of a trick, is that there is no formal definition of the forecast that CBO actually offers. It involves judgment by the director of CBO about what Congress is likely to do. So even if we, you know, drastically cut Medicare and Social Security without cutting payroll taxes so that these programs started contributing to a massive projected surplus, CBO might well judge that that was a for show, that the future Congress was going to reverse it and give you a modified baseline in which those things were taken out. And then the deficit would still be there, and they'd say, no, do something else. So this is not a problem which can be cured by any particular round of congressional action. At the same time, it's not a problem it's a problem that would go away if the sort of consistent statutory foundation of the CBO baseline were used.
Well, I say if we let those tax cuts expire as they're supposed to, and if we got out of Iraq and Afghanistan, there would be no deficit problem to speak of. But we're not talking really about those things. But
I want to take a little exception to the notion of deficit problem. What is the deficit problem? You might say I think it would be accurate to say that if CBO allowed the currently programmed expiration of the Bush tax cuts to stand in the baseline, then its deficit forecast would be stable. That would not be a cure to any problem, but it would cause the rhetoric behind this hysteria to go away, which would be a good thing.
Medicare, though, is another issue. The healthcare spending is projected, and probably reasonably so, to rise considerably in the coming years and decades. What's your attitude towards that? Is that something we should worry about, or something we should? How should we approach this, if at all?
Well, Medicare, of course, is not the problem for healthcare spending. Healthcare spending, the problem there is the cost of providing the services, and that's a that's a complex issue. The costs are high, in part because we throw a lot of technology at the problem, in part because we pay the providers very handsomely for providing it. Medicare, in fact, pays them less than private insurance. So when you deal with healthcare costs overall, you would be dealing with both the actual cost of providing healthcare and the budget cost of providing Medicare. Cutting Medicare services as a way of going about this is just extremely poor public policy. What it amounts to is saying that for completely arbitrary reasons, we're going to cut health care available to old people. Old people are the people on Medicare, right? And if you cut Medicare, you're cutting health care for people over 65, but not cutting it for people under 65. Does this make any kind of sense? People over 65 need health care. Inevitably need quite a lot of it as they get older. It is an arbitrary cruelty to focus the problem of health care costs on the Medicare program.
We're listening to James Galbraith, a professor of economics at the University of Texas and editor of the Library of America's collection of his father's works. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear more from Jamie Galbraith.
Ignore my trembling hands.
That was some of the Mekon's Hello, Cruel World. And now back to James Galbraith. For the first part of the show, he was talking about the present situation. Now let's hear what he has to say about the collection he edited for the Library of America, consisting of the full text of four of his father, John Kenneth Galbraith's, most famous works: American Capitalism, The Great Crash 1929, The Affluent Society, and The New Industrial State. I regret we didn't have the time to take up some other of Galbraith Pair's favorite themes, particularly his critique of the American penchant for private wealth and public squalor. Believe it or not, googling around, I came across a few right-wingers who think that is a good thing. In the words of one blogger, buy India, sell China. Evidently, India's public squalor portends good things, while China's snazzy new public infrastructure portends bad things. In a famous example, Galbraith noted that the household purchase of a vacuum cleaner is widely regarded as a good thing, but a municipal purchase of a street sweeper is seen as wasteful, giving us clean houses and dirty streets. He wrote this in the 1950s. 50 years later, the distinction is even sharper. Jaguars, yes. Social Security, no. Okay, here's James Galbraith. All right, welcome back. The Library of America has published your collection of four of your father's books. He wrote many more than that. How do you choose which ones to go in?
Well, the Library of America will, I hope, eventually publish additional volumes so that we will be moving toward a complete compendium of my father's work under their marvelous imprimatur. These four, American Capitalism, The Great Crash, The Affluent Society, and The New Industrial State, are the most important books on economics that my father wrote at the peak of his career, beginning with American Capitalism, which was published in 1952, and we sold about 250,000 copies at the time, introduced the concept of countervailing power, tried to give an authentic image of the emerging structure of the American economy. The Great Crash, which was 1955, which was the first book to give a narrative account of what had happened in the summer and fall of 1929, and which is an enduring classic. It's, in fact, of all of my father's books, it's, I think, by a substantial margin, the biggest seller. The Affluent Society came out in 1958 and was the book that, at that time, I think, really made him into the worldwide figure that he remained for much of the rest of his career. It was a deep critique of the core ideas of classical, neoclassical economics, and an introduction to the concerns of the late 20th century, from environmentalism to feminism in many ways. And The New Industrial State was his effort to come to grips with the structure of an economy dominated by large industrial corporations. So that really spans, in those four books span in many ways the most important ideas that constituted my father's contributions.
And you didn't write an introduction?
No, and it's not a practice in the Library of America. The general editor writes the chronology, so I contributed that, some of the reviewers were kind enough to notice that it's a bit entertaining. But no, the general editor does not generally write an introduction.
I noticed that, too. What was it like? You became an economist. What was it like to grow up under the shadow of one of the giants in the field?
Well, it certainly was a window at a very high level and permitted me to form direct personal relationship with and opinions of practically all of the leading economic figures of the 1950s through the 1970s. At the time that my career started, which it did on Capitol Hill, I was then in a position to make acquaintances and friends of everybody else as well. So that, I think, is the first thing, is that the economics profession was not just a set of works on paper, but a group of individuals whom I largely knew personally. From my father's position inside the profession was always one of, I won't say dissidence, but individualism. And he was a leading figure with a distinctive perspective, of whom there were quite a number in Cambridge, Mass. In the 50s and 60s. My father, I think, stood out from that group for being better known, more widely read, and a more wide-ranging public figure than most of them. But still, it perhaps gave me the sense that you need to follow your own lights in this area, and that's perhaps a second important influence that he had over me.
These four books are certainly they intervene in economic debates, but they're not written primarily for a specialist audience. They don't require a whole lot of study and prerequisites in economic study. They were written in very clear, elegant English prose for an educated audience, and then not full of mathematical models and all the characteristic tics of the field today. What about his relation to that? What the orthodox practice of economics?
Well, it wasn't so orthodox at the time. Remember that my father's training came in the 1930s, and economics, as he developed and practiced it, was something that you could express in clear and lucid prose pretty effectively. It wasn't until really the next generation that came along, by the time he was already a senior figure in the 1950s, that had a hermetic and mathematized vision of what economics was. Not to say that my dad wasn't able to use empirical evidence. So early on in his career, he was director of the United States Strategic Bombing Survey, which was one of the great statistical operations ever mounted by a group of economists assessing the effect of bombing on the German and Japanese war economies. But his basic position was that the ideas of economics and the tradition that came down from Smith and Ricardo and Marx and Keynes was a tradition with a very strong literary element and a tradition which had to speak to a broader public if it was going to be worth pursuing.
Okay, let's talk about some of the major themes of his work. Of the four, the only one I hadn't really read before was American Capitalism. I was struck reading that by some of the quotes in the early pages from a publicist for the National Association of Manufacturers and such, who are saying that we're like 92% of the way to socialism. I was very curious about how they came up with that exact number, but they seem to have some kind of feeling that we're only 8% short. These, in those days, were rather marginal characters, and now the kinds of ravings that he quotes as almost quaint are dominant in the discourse. What happened in the last decades that's all been reversed?
Well, one of the things that happened is that the economics profession became so dissociated from reality and so supportive of this fantasy narrative that it basically made it very difficult to write and think in a clear way about the economy as it actually is. One of the things I tried to do most recently in the little book I published 3 years ago, The Predator State, which is subtitled How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too, was to explore the way in which the discourse available to liberals had been constrained by the necessity to pay homage to these free market notions and shibboleths, and the way in which actual conservatives in power use public authority, use the public purse, use the regulatory power to get what they want without any reference to free, decentralized, and unregulated markets by any stretch of the imagination. So I think one of the great difficulties we face is that we have lost a community of scholars who are talking about the real world, about the structure of the world as it exists, as opposed to the structure of fantasy models that they can write about and get published about in the scientific journals.
Now, one of the bits of received wisdom he was arguing against now almost 60 years ago, was the notion of universality of competition, that the standard economic model was that the economy is dominated by small firms who are price takers, had no influence over the conditions under which they operated, and they just had to deal with the world their competitors made. He argued that that was no longer the case. Not quite sure if it ever was, but it certainly was no longer the case in the 20th century U.S. What do you think of that argument now, 60 years later? Is this, did he win it, or are we still in the grips of the competitive model?
Well, the competitive model, and the problem is the competitive model still forms the foundation of what undergraduates and even graduate students in this field are taught. My father's vision, particularly in American capitalism, of a chain of countervailing authorities was then and is now far more realistic. It's not to say that the world hasn't changed since the last of these books, The New Industrial State, was first published in 1967. It has. We live in a world which is much more conditioned by outside industrial powers. Initially, Japan and then Korea and now China play a much larger role now than they did in my father's day. The rise of China, for example, hardly constitutes a validation of the notion that the world is full of perfectly competitive small firms.
One of the players in that game of countervailing power, though, has largely disappeared. That is unions. Does that matter?
Well, sure it does. Unions have lost members both absolutely, but especially proportionately. They were very strong in manufacturing. And at the time that American capitalism appeared, manufacturing was probably 30 or 40% of employment, and unionization was about 30% of the workforce. These days, manufacturing is probably around 11% of employment, and unionization is, I don't know, probably 8 or 7% last time I looked. So they are no longer have political power on the same scale. How does it matter? I mean, I think it matters for wage levels, but it also matters for the structure of our politics. It's clear that the Democratic Party, which at one point fostered a very powerful alliance with unions, is now a subsidiary of financial firms on economic policy matters. And there's essentially no significant representation from working people or other popular organizations in the way economic policy is made. And that it's true of the Democrats and even more true when the Republicans are in power, which tells you something about the actual fate of democracy in this country.
I'm speaking with James Galbraith, who is a professor of economics at the University of Texas and also editor of the Library of America collection of his father's works, four of his major works. In American Capitalism, he criticizes liberals of the time for being partisans of antitrust and actually says in many ways that this world of somewhat competitive giants, not textbook competition that we were talking about earlier, but they are in competition with each other in some sense, that is actually is better for economic performance to have these guys rather than an aggressive antitrust policy. What do you think of that?
My father's view was that the large corporation was a necessity for technological reasons, that you had to have a sophisticated, complex organization in order to make use of scientific and technical knowledge. You needed, there's an example of the New Industrial State, which the automobile needs to be able to take advantage of the metallurgist, of the chemist, of the engineer, of the specialist in tires, and all of the various pieces that go together to make up a car. And to do that, you have to have a complex, large organization. So he did not believe that antitrust was a serious progressive response to the abuse of power by corporations. As if you basically broke up corporations into small entities, you wouldn't get the same products on a more competitive basis. You would simply be saying we're not going to have those products at all.
And competition did reign to a greater degree in relatively backward fields like agriculture and garments, right?
Well, I don't think my father was ever under any illusions about the role of competition in agriculture. He came out of a farming background and started as an agricultural economist, worked in the Agricultural Adjustment Administration in the New Deal. This was a sector which was continued to exist only thanks to a vast array of public programs and stabilization. So the fact about agriculture was, yes, you had a lot of small entities, but they survived thanks to to farm credit, to agricultural extension, to price supports, and commodity programs, and all of those were absolutely essential to maintaining them in some functional, as functionally viable.
His model of the large farm, particularly in the new industrial state, was one in which it was controlled by management and technocrats, and financial markets and stockholders had largely receded from importance. That has changed dramatically. What do you think the effects, what's different and why, and what's it done to us?
Well, it has changed dramatically. In the 60s and up through the early 70s, large corporations dictated the terms of finance to their bankers. And they had options. If they didn't get a bank loan, they could issue commercial paper. And they basically were making their investment decisions looking forward on their markets, not backwards at their financial conditions. Things changed dramatically in the 80s when interest rates went up, and that restored in many ways the power of the banker over the company. It destabilized corporations, turned many of them into entities where speculative bets, for example, on exchange rates, were more important than the actual efficiency of their productive operations. So we've undergone 30 years of financialization of the increasing power of the financial sector, and we now live in a world in which the financial sector makes the fundamental industrial decisions. This is a very unstable world. Sometimes it takes off in a direction which you might think is, you know, more or less a good thing. The information technology revolution was driven by a lot of financial players placing big bets on new firms, and some of them paid off, and a great many of them did not. But the reality is now we've come to a dead end of economic growth driven by the financial sector. For the last decade, they were making it up by with mortgage loans and derivatives, the structured financial products that were sold to the world investment community based on mortgages. That was largely fraudulent and has caused the epic collapse of home values and middle-class wealth in this country. And the financial sector now has not got any, it's not exercising any leadership going forward, nor will it. It may put some money in speculative bets on commodities, but there is no path for industrial development that I can see that will ever be led by this financial sector. So we're looking at a period, 30 years, in which things did change from my father's time, but we've got a major problem that we have not resolved.
And there really, this kind of undermines any kind of notion of countervailing powers, just the financial markets with no labor unions to speak of and mighty financial markets and government clearly a handmaiden of the financial sector. Are there countervailing powers remaining?
Well, the cost of not having countervailing power becomes very clear. I think that's a very interesting point, yes.
You were just talking about the financial chicanery in the recent cycle. What was it like to take another look at the Great Crash, 1929? Did it seem like you only had to change a few names and we're explaining the present?
There's a huge amount of similarity between these two episodes, that's for sure. I did write a foreword for one of the most recent editions of the Great Crash, and one of the arguments I made in that foreword was that there was a big difference, that the late 1920s were a time of speculative euphoria, of real happiness on the part of people who thought wrongly, as it turns out, that the stock market was making them very, very rich. I don't think we saw that in the housing debacle. The housing debacle was pillage. It was taking advantage of people who needed to get their roofs repaired. And selling them loans, refinancings for the most part, cash out refinancings to a very large degree, which the originators knew they could not afford. Nobody who took out those loans was under the impression that they were getting rich, that they were benefiting from some great new invention or great new phase in American history. There had been some of that a decade before in the technology boom. but not in the housing bubble that led to the great financial crisis. So this is a gloomier and darker period, even than the 1920s was.
Yeah, and that reminds me, another is a recurring theme, particularly in the affluent society, is that economics as a profession was founded, really, in times when people were quite poor, and only a very small minority of the population was rich, and the benefits their wealth afforded them were actually modest compared to what is common today. Economics need to recast itself or rethink itself in different ways for a time of far more universal prosperity. Now we are feeling poor again. Are we talking ourselves poor? The austerity party is certainly fueled by notions that we're too poor to afford all kinds of things. But also people do feel poor and a lack of optimism about the economic prospects for the future. Where are we? Is the affluent society still an accurate description of where we live?
Well, I'll point to one area where we are clearly in a moment of epic change, and that's on energy and the environment. The affluent society came out at a moment when energy was very cheap and no one had ever heard of climate change. We are now clearly moving into a period where energy prices are a major constraint on economic expansion, and where the damage that we've done to the environment is accumulating, and we're feeling it as we speak. We're already experiencing the consequences, and they will only get worse over time. So economics needs to reassociate itself with the physical world in a serious way, and I'm not even sure that the economics profession is capable of doing that, so it would be necessary to replace it with something else that was. But that's where we are, and that's a serious sense in which we have we live in a much different world from the 1950s. That said, the claim that the problem is being caused by insurance programs that help the most vulnerable people in society, old people, survivors, dependents, the ill, that those people should be to bear the burden of adjustment, is a very special claim. It's a claim driven by a very particular form of special interests on the part of a very small part of the population that doesn't have any need for those programs personally and doesn't want to contribute anything to them. And the country just has to decide, are they going to go along with that, or are they going to find a way of being governed in a way that supports the community at large.
And do you have a feeling which way we're going to go?
Well, I can't say I'm optimistic, but I'm fond of quoting my friend Bill Black, who quotes William of Orange, who said famously that it is not necessary to hope in order to persevere.
We've been listening to James Galbraith, a professor of economics at the University of Texas and editor of the Library of America's collection of his father's works. They're well worth reading, not only for their humanity and intelligence, but also because they're often quite funny. In talking about the expansion of the financial sector over the last few decades, I didn't want to insert my own point of view too aggressively. But since this is my show, I'll do it now. The financial sector was small and passive during the first few decades after the end of World War II because finance had little to complain about. Profits were strong and the stock market did well. That started changing in the late 1960s, as inflation rose, productivity sagged, and profits softened. Those problems intensified in the 1970s. Also, over those decades, the nature of share ownership changed, with stocks more and more controlled by institutions like pension funds and less by individuals. That meant that there were fewer hands involved, and they were more like a professional guild that knew each other and compared notes and could take collective action. So starting in the late 1970s and accelerating in the 1980s, shareholders became far more assertive, demanding that the corporations whose shares they owned cut costs and jack up profits. That meant an end to the comfortable mediocrity of the corporate technostructure that Galbraith described in The New Industrial State, giving rise to the more aggressive, hyperactive corporate culture of today. Also, another reminder of how the world has changed. Galbraith wrote about the anonymity of the businessman as bureaucrat, and they're all men in those days. With the roughening and toughening of the corporate culture, we've seen the emergence of the celebrity entrepreneur and investor. There were no figures like Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, or Warren Buffett in the 1950s. Now, of course, there are. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, Mission of Burma's cover of a 1978 song by the California punk band, The Dills. Class War. Till next week, bye.